name off the dedication of his Eroica Symphony. This week, we'll be hearing some of the music Napoleon sang in the bath and some he didn't much care for, pieces by composers he poached or plundered, and we'll be hearing how popular songs of the day evolved into revolutionary anthems. Composer of the Week, each weekday at 12 and again at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Sir John Major was Prime Minister of this country from 1990 to 1997. Headlines, and indeed achievements from that period, would include the transition from poll tax to council tax, the negotiation of the Maastricht Treaty, the building of the foundation stones for a resolution of the Northern Ireland dispute, and the creation of the National Lottery. He's written an autobiography, a book on his other passion, cricket, and now a personal history of the music hall, My Old Man. Actually, from the point of view of the arts, the National Lottery has been a very important creation.
It was intended to be. The reason I decided to form the lottery was that many of the things that enhance people's lives, sport, culture, the arts, the heritage of old buildings, were never going to get much support from the taxpayer. They really couldn't compete with social security, social services, health, education. And I was looking for a way, apart from the government, of raising a lot of money, because I think these are matters that really are important to the lifestyles of very many people. And I'm delighted the way it's been such a success over so long. I think the arts are very important. There is some instinct within all of us, and has been since cavemen, for artistic achievement of one sort or another. And I think we are very lucky in the United Kingdom. The arts here, the theatre here in particular, is better than I have seen it anywhere in the world. A quality of performance that I don't see equaled anywhere else, including Broadway.
And last year, you could and would have said that extended that supremacy to cricket.
Well, cricket comes and goes. I mean, there are moments when we're on top. There are moments when other nations, Australia most obviously, in the last 100 years, have a cricketing dominance. It's part of the joy of the game, that it's unpredictable. You never quite know when a cricketing genius will appear, a Bradman, a Lara, a Warne, who will change the balance of power between cricketing nations. They appear from time to time, and it's truly wonderful that they do. But I hope the balance will tilt back towards England.
Your first music is Johann Strauss, and I think this is simply a piece you just revel in more than any particular chronological reason.
That's exactly right. It's not actually a very original choice, the overture from Die Fledermaus, probably one of the most popular overtures in opera, operetta, that has ever been written. But it's such a joyous piece, particularly the waltz centre of it. And I find you can imagine people dancing to it. And it's such a foolish story, as is so much of opera and operetta. But it brings it to life. People often accuse opera and operetta of being a bit elitist. I wonder how many of the critics realise how much opera was actually played in the working class music halls in the 1850s. The first great music hall was the Canterbury, built by a man called Charles Morton, and a regular part of their programme was extracts from Trovatore, Traviata, Lucia de Lammermoor, A Masked Ball, and Faust, which actually premiered in Paris, where it was a sensation, had never been heard in England. And extracts from Faust sung by Miss Russell were first played at the music hall in the Canterbury, in Lambeth Marshes, in the late 1850s.
That's absolutely fascinating. So I hadn't realised to what an extent the music hall helped the birth of opera and opera ballet in that way. We heard the overture to Die Fledermaus by Johann Strauss II, played by the Vienna Symphony Orchestra, conducted by that great Straussian Willy Boskowski. That brings us very neatly, John Major, onto your book. And I think the best introduction that I can imagine to it is a very charming quote from the book, which is in fact on the back of it. And perhaps I could just ask you to read it.
Yes, of course. In March 1962, I sat with an old man as he lay dying. He was barely conscious, with familiar half-smiles dancing across his well-worn and gentle face. But I knew where he was in his imagination, where he wanted to be. The lights were bright. A boisterous audience was cheering. Aged 82, and over 30 years since he'd left it, he was back on the stage. He was my father, Tom.
And so that's where this great love of the music hall came from. I remember when I was very young, I mean, you know, about eight, we had a bus conductress who lived next door called Mrs. Dirks, a Clippy as they used to call, and she took me to the Met in the Edgware Road. And that was quite a focal point. And it was extraordinary how many people from the locale would come to those variety shows. I mean, they were the popular entertainment, weren't they?
They were the entertainment. I mean, from 1840 through really to the birth of cinema, they were the predominant entertainment. And they were for the people, they were by the people. And the entertainment, particularly of the comedians and singers, actually reflected the lives of their audiences. And my father was in music hall for 30 years. And when he was old and sick, and I was still a young boy, he was 65 when I was born, I would sit by his bed and he would reminisce. He had lost his sight and his health. And I was his audience. And he introduced me to people who were flesh and blood to him, Murray Lloyd, Dan Leno, Little Titch, Gertie Gaetana, all the great stars, but were just legend and memories to people today. So I absorbed a good deal of this at his bedside. And often he would recite some of the monologues that he and his first wife had written for their own shows, and he would sing. And the two songs he would sing most often were After the Ball and The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery, except in his case it would be The Girl I Love Is Up in the Gallery. And I can see him there. He became so happy when he talked about that. He went back years earlier. Clearly the greatest moments of his professional life had been those precious moments when he was on stage. It was in his blood. It was in his instinct. And he loved the reality of performing and the response that he got. And I learned to love the theatre and to admire the music hall sitting at his bedside many, many years ago.
Just come over from the country where they do things big. And amongst the boys I've got a lover. And since I've got a lover, why, I don't care a fig. The boy I love is up in the gallery. The boy I love is looking down at me. There he is, can't you see, waving of his handkerchief, as merry as a robin that sings on a tree. Now Now, if I were a duchess and had a lot of money, I'd give it to the boy who's going to marry me. But I haven't got a penny, so we'll live on love and kisses and be just as happy as the birds on a tree. The boy I love is up in the gallery. The boy I love is looking down at me. There he is, can't you see, waving of his handkerchief, as merry as a robin that sings on a tree. Ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about the boy. On the silver screen, he melts my foolish heart in every single scene. Although I'm quite aware that here and there are traces of the cat about the boy. Lord knows I'm not a fool girl. Not a schoolgirl in the flurry of her first affair. Will it ever cloy, this odd diversity of misery and joy? I'm feeling quite insane and young again, and all because I'm mad about the boy. Mad about the boy. It's pretty funny, but I'm mad about the boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about the boy. Walking down the street, his eyes look out at me from people that I meet. I can't believe it's true, but when I'm blue in some strange way, I'm glad about the boy. I know it seems that I'm hardly sentimental. Sublime. I have to pay my rental and I can't afford to waste much time. And so if I could employ a little magic that would finally destroy this dream that pains me and enchains me, but I can't, 'cause I'm utterly mad about the boy. Quite insane and young again, and all because I'm mad, mad about the boy.
We've got two for the price of one there.
Noel Coward as a bonus to George Weir. Yes. Very nice.
The Boy I Love is up in the gallery by George Weir. Noel Coward's Mad About the Boy. Maria Friedman and Jason Carr was the music director. So, was there quite a bit of music in your childhood of one sort or another?
There was a great deal of singing, yes, from my father.
You didn't get to play an instrument at that point?
No. I mean, that is the reason for my next choice in a moment. But no, I didn't. I never had the opportunity to play an instrument. And in truth, I don't think I have the ear for it. I love music, and I spend many hours listening to it of all sorts. But I don't think I have the ability to recreate it in any acceptable fashion, either with my voice or with an instrument. And I greatly envy those people with that talent.
So if you were able to play, the next piece is the kind of thing you'd like to do?
Oh, absolutely. Norma's father was a pianist. And I would love to have been able to play the piano. And I remember many years ago, there were several pianists who became very popular, and some people listening will remember them. Mrs. Mills, Winifred Atwell, and then a little later, Russ Conray, who played wonderful honky-tonk party pieces that were really great. And I think of the three, the one I enjoyed most was Winifred Atwell. I would give a great deal to be able to play like that. I mean, how can you listen to that and not smile and tap your feet? It's just so infectious.
Well, I'm glad to say we were both smiling there.
We were.
Winifred Atwell was playing The Black and White Rag by George Botsford. When I think, John, of your time as Prime Minister, I mentioned just now some of the sort of highlights. Which of those two of you, just talking about what your father was proud of, when you look back in your 80s, what do you think you'll feel were the things you were really happy about?
It's very difficult to choose. But if I explain something, I suffered as a child, or rather my family did, because my father lost all his money and lived in very poor circumstances. So I've always been very sensitive to the impact of economic conditions. When I became Prime Minister in 1990, we were heading for a terrible economic mess. Interest rates were 15%. Inflation was coming up to 9%. When I left in 1997, I think I left by common consent the best economic circumstances that any outgoing government has left for a very long time. Now, since that directly impacts upon the lives of everyone to a greater or lesser degree, and particularly upon those who do not have very much, I think that change is something that I'll look back on with a great deal of pleasure. That and the Northern Ireland peace process will be the two big things, I think, that I would look back on.
You will also look back very happily to the reason for our next music.
Yes, I will.
Which indeed was, I think, your marriage to Norma.
It was. It was. Norma and I got married in 1970 at St Matthew's Church in Brixton. And many years before, Norma had shared a flat with June Bronhill, the soprano, who sang Lucia and so much else, and The Merry Widow. And at our wedding, she came to sing, and she sang Gounod's Ave Maria. But there's other reasons I particularly want June to sing. When we had been married for a couple of years, I think Elizabeth was born and was a baby, and James was a bump. We went to the West Country and stayed at a nearly empty chantry. And it was a gloriously hot fortnight while we were there. And the chantry was big, deserted, and nearly empty. And I played repeatedly a June Bronhill's album of sacred songs. And it echoed as though it was in a vast cathedral. And I think of all the records I have ever heard, that is the one at the time that made the greatest impact upon me.
That was the Bach prelude with the Ave Maria aria that Gounod put on top of it, and we heard June Bronhill singing it. The next music is, of course, a ballet, but I think you probably encountered it, life, as it were.
A wholly different life. This particular piece of music is a choice to remind me of my late mother-in-law, Dee. Dee's husband died in the last days of the war, and then Norma's younger brother died, and Dee was left to bring up Norma on her own. And of course they had a very close bond. And after we were married, we would spend every Sunday having dinner with Dee. And we would have a very early dinner in order to sit down in front of the television and watch the Aeneidin Line. And the theme music of the Aeneidin Line was the Adagio from the ballet Spartacus by Cacciaturian.
Thank you.
The Adagio of Spartacus and Phrygia from the ballet Spartacus by Khachaturian, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Aram Khachaturian. It is curious, isn't it, John Major, the way a great soaring melody can sort of seize you by the throat.
Music can lift you up. And indeed, the next choice I hope to come to in a minute is a piece of music that whenever you're down, there are some pieces of music that will lift your mood and change it entirely. And my next choice is one of those.
Well, actually, I'm grateful to you for this because I don't think we've had it on the programme.
Oh, good.
Well, so I'm you've hit a first there. A six, if you like. In your
I'm delighted to hear it. The six is always very welcome.
Well, and it comes, doesn't it, from Robinson Crusoe
by
Offenbach.
Offenbach. It comes from an album by Joan Sutherland. Norma was Joan's biographer. And we've known Joan Sutherland and Richard Bonning for a long time. Sunday morning she'll phone up and it'll say it's Joan. And it's a moment before you realised it was the Joan rather than one of many other Joans that we might know. But I think she had one of the voices of the century, an absolutely magnificent voice. And her Romantic French Arias album is one of those albums that just lifts your mood entirely. And I could, in truth, have chosen anything from the album. But I chose the Waltz Song by Offenbach because I think it's a particularly good example, and the skill and the breath control that's evident on that album and in this particular song is truly remarkable.
Thank you.
Conduisez-moi vers celui qui j'adore, the waltz song from Robinson Crusoe by Offenbach, Joan Sutherland with the Orchestra of the Suisse Romande, conducted by Richard Bonning. Well, it's the music that accompanied the 1992 election that we move on to here now, John Major, because actually it got you to know very well this marvellous tune.
Yes, it is. And I'm grateful to Andrew Lloyd Webber for that. It's actually The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra by Benjamin Britten. And Andrew was a great admirer of Benjamin Britten. But Andrew reorchestrated it, rearranged it. And it was the theme music we used for all my appearances during the 1992 election. And of course, the 92 election is the one that I just won, rather than the later election that I rather more than just lost.
The uplifting theme to The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra by Benjamin Britten, who was there himself conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. I can see why one might think that that would inspire a feeling of confidence.
Well, it certainly enlivened the audience. Everybody liked it. It cheered them up. It was an attractive way to enter the stage. And it worked extremely well. And it was a theme song that people began to know. And it worked extremely well during that election. And it is a very attractive piece of music.
Now, we were talking, John Major, about the way a theme, especially when it's allied to a narrative or a visual image, can be utterly memorable. And that's certainly true of this next music and the film that accompanied it.
Well, I chose this. It's Lara's theme from David Lean's film of Dr. Zhivago. I chose it for several reasons. Firstly, I love the music. I think it's a beautiful piece of music. But also, I was in Raffles Hotel in Singapore a few years ago, and just inside the entrance, there is a pianist who plays consistently near the bar. And I was there one evening, and he asked me what I would like him to play, and I said Lara's theme, and he played it. And every single time since that I have been into Raffles and walked up the great stairway that is adjacent to the door, the pianist would begin to play Lara's theme. So it became a theme.
A play it again, Sam.
It was a play it again, Sam moment. And it was a lovely piece of music from a great film, from a very great book. And I read the book before I saw the film, but I think the film is a remarkable depiction of what was in the book.
It's very interesting, isn't it, how difficult it is for a film to transcend a great novel, because a great novel sparks the neurons of your imagination, whereas a film is more literal.
It is. And also, of course, when you have read the novel, you have a vision in your mind of what the characters are like and how they look. And if you suddenly find someone you had assumed was dark-haired appears on screen fair-haired, it destroys it. But I found in Dr. Zhivago that none of that happened, that it was beautifully done. And I think it is one of the great films that have been made.
Those films of that time, Dr. Zhivago, Lawrence of Arabia, another one.
Another great film.
Have that kind of breadth, that epic quality to them, don't they?
They are epic, and I think they're enduring. They're enduring because of the story, but they're enduring also because they far exceeded the normal quality of film you could have expected at that time. Just like Gone with the Wind, which for 1938 was beyond belief. You can see the joins now, but it was beyond belief good for anything else you'd seen at that time. And this is true of these rather later films. They made a very special impact.
Maurice Jarre's Lara's theme from David Lean's 1965 film, Dr. Zhivago. We heard the MGM Studio Orchestra conducted by Maurice Jarre, the composer. Rodgers and Hammerstein next. And here we are getting a musical, but where the music has, especially in the rendition, an almost operatic quality.
Well, this was a great treat for me. It takes me back to my teenage years. I guess I must have been 14, 15, something of that sort, when South Pacific was released, and it was quite remarkable. I remember buying the old LP. I had no money then, but I'd saved up to go to the theatre. I think it was the Empire Leicester Square, but I couldn't be certain. And I went to see the film version of South Pacific. And it is a wonderful film. But there was one song right in the middle of it for the pure drama and excitement that absolutely stopped me in my tracks. And that was This Nearly Was Mine, allegedly sung by Rosano Brazzi, but in practice his voice was dubbed by Giorgio Tozzi. And it is a magnificently dramatic song to appear in the middle of a Rodgers and Hammerstein musical.
This Nearly Was Mine, from the 1958 recording of South Pacific by Rodgers and Hammerstein. We heard Giorgio Tozzi with an orchestra conducted by Alfred Newman. Well, thank you very much, John Major. You led us out of one conflict during your time as Prime Minister in Northern Ireland, but I imagine taking a country into conflict must be almost unbearably problematic.
I would be very cautious about taking people to war. Old men take young men to war, and young women, but it is the young men and young women who get killed. And I discovered during the period I was Prime Minister that so are the generals. the people who see war at its most gruesome, at its most close, at its most vital, are very keen to avoid it if they can. I was Prime Minister during the first Gulf War. I was glad I didn't face, during my period in office, the necessity of going to war again. If I had to, I would have done so. So if you can negotiate honourably your way away from war, then I think you should try and do so. War should be absolutely the last resort. And every senior British general that I have known would echo that thought.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sir John Major was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the fashion designer Caroline Charles. That'll be at midday next Sunday. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper. And you can hear Michael Barclay on Radio 4 this coming Tuesday. In It's My Story, he talks about coming to terms with his partial deafness and talks to others in the music world who suffer similarly. That's at 4 o'clock this Tuesday afternoon over on BBC Radio 4. And Michael's also a guest on tomorrow's In Tune here on Radio 3 at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon.
Maxim Vengerov plays the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. Radio 3 live in concert at London's Barbican with the LSO and Robin Ticciati and Elgar's Enigma Variations. We explore the work in the interval in discovering music and reveal the recipient of the 8th Queen's Medal for Music. A special Royal Radio 3 live in concert, Wednesday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high definition sound. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news, read by me, Jonathan Swain. The Chancellor George Osborne has said that he will announce measures in this week's autumn statement to make Britain's wealthiest people contribute more to the Treasury. He also says the mini-budget will include further cuts to welfare spending. Mr Osborne accepted that clearing the deficit, the gap between the government's income and its expenditure, won't now happen before 2015, as he'd hoped. The coffee shop chain Starbucks has said it will review how it pays tax in the UK. The company, which pays no corporation tax, said it had listened to its customers and wanted to maintain and build public trust. More than 100,000 people have now signed an online petition on the regulation of newspapers, which was launched 2 days ago. It calls on David Cameron to change his mind and implement Lord Justice Leveson's recommendation that a new regulatory body for the press is backed up by a law. The chairman of the Press Complaints Commission, Lord Hunt, says he believes editors will join a new independent body to oversee their newspapers. Egypt's highest court has suspended its work indefinitely because of what it calls a climate filled with hatred. The Constitutional Court was meant to decide today on whether an Islamist-dominated panel that drafted a controversial constitution is legitimate, but judges were unable to enter a courthouse to make the decision because of demonstrations in support of the constitution. Thousands of cheering supporters have welcomed the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas on his return to the West Bank from New York. The United Nations voted to upgrade the status of the Palestinians. Speaking at a rally in Ramallah, Mr. Abbas said the path had been very long, but they had stood fast and won. 4 Afghan soldiers and 2 civilians have been killed in an attack by Taliban suicide bombers on a military base in eastern Afghanistan. A number of NATO troops were wounded. Vehicles laden with explosives were driven at the gates of the joint US-Afghan base near Jalalabad. And the weather, many areas sunny and cold, although a few wintry showers for northern Scotland and near eastern coasts. And that's the news and the weather with the time coming up to 1:03. Today is Advent Sunday, and at 4 o'clock this afternoon,
a service for Advent with carols from the Chapel of St. John's, Cambridge. The run-up to Christmas begins. A service for Advent with carols from the Chapel of St John's, Cambridge. This afternoon from 4 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And right now it's time to join Catherine Bott for the Early Music Show, which has more on the Advent theme.
Now come, the Saviour of the heathen, manifest Son of the Virgin, at which the whole world marvels that God hath ordained thee such a birth. The opening to Bach's cantata BWV 61, Nun komm der Heidenheiland, performed by Collegium Vocale, directed by Philipp Herwege. This being the first Sunday in Advent, I could easily fill today's edition of the Early Music Show with all the different ways in which Bach's music welcomes the imminent birth of the Messiah, from that rather solemn and awestruck chorale to the trumpeting joy of the Christmas oratorio. But instead, I've got some surprises, including some new releases, and I'm even going to bend the rules a bit later on to play a setting of Praetorius that shows how a great Renaissance tune thrives on being enrobed in new harmonies. Our next piece is from a new recording of music from 18th century Prague. The composer is Jan Dismas Zelenka, the artists are Musica Floria, and the piece we're going to hear is a reminder that, months before the first Christmas, there was the visit of the angel Gabriel to a girl called Mary, who, when she'd recovered from her astonishment at his salutation, declared, "My soul doth magnify the Lord."